You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
So, ladies and gentlemen, they really don't need that much of an introduction. You know they've been on for 12 years, over 600 episodes. They've won the People's Choice Podcast Award 5 times. They are boasting over 300,000 downloads per episode and over 1 million likes on Facebook. Actually, it's 1,115,958. Hold on. 59. I held out so I could do it here. And I absolutely love their Facebook cover photo. They're dressed as the Star Trek Landing Party original series. So please welcome, without further ado, the cast of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, July 1st, 2017, and we are presenting live from Nexus 2017. Joining me on stage are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, New York.
And we are joined by our good friend from Down Under, Richard Saunders.
Hello. Hello.
Richard, this is your first time in New York City.
I love it. New York. I mean, wow, it's just like the movies. And I must say, I was very pleased. I went to Times Square last night for the first time at night. Blew my mind. But I was delighted to say that New York's keeping up with the times. I got a leaflet on the rapture. Fantastic. I can't wait for that. You'll be pleased to know there's a passage in here. It says, what to do in case you miss the rapture. The advice is, stay calm and do not panic. So, thank Douglas, you, New York.
Douglas Adams told us that as well.
Right. Don't panic. All right, so our Nexus live show every year is always our memorial episode. And in fact, this whole thing kind of evolved, meaning Nexus, kind of evolved out of the Perry DeAngelis Memorial SGU show that we did in New York City.
10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah. Mm-hmm. That kind of sparked Nexus. That's why it's 9 years, right? This is the ninth one. And then we like to remember close friends that we lost along the way, like Michael Orticelli, and recently...
David Young.
We lost a new friend, David Young, who is the head of the Hong Kong Skeptics, who passed away this year from ALS. And he, again, these are all people, Mike Lassell, of course, as well, who started out as our number one fan and then just became an integral part of our show. So these are people who dedicated really a large part of their life to supporting skeptical activism and working together with us. They're all dearly, dearly missed, but we will always remember them on the SGU. Thank you.
On to something very special. I have to contact NASA right now. Actually, I'm going to contact Mission Control. So Mission Control, this is SGU 627. We're ready for broadcast.
Roger that, SGU 627.
Initiate downlink connection now, please.
SGU 627, Mission Control. We have received good data, ready to execute.
Roger that, Mission Control.
SGU 627, Mission Control, broadcast in 3, 2.
I'm Colonel Jack Fisher, a NASA astronaut aboard the International Space Station. It's great to be able to join you today as a part of your Nexus conference. I wish I could have been there with you in person, but we're involved in a lot of activity here on the space station. Everything from making spacewalk repairs to the arrival of commercial cargo supply spacecraft to the challenges of conducting the important research we are involved in every single day. While I know many people focus on the skeptics part of Nexus, I know you're part of an organization that promotes science, critical thinking, and creative arts. Our most important reason for being here is science. During my time on the station, I'll be helping to conduct and supervise about 250 different experiments that range from testing and evaluating drugs for cancer treatment, rebuilding bone loss, to a variety of experiments that will provide us new insights on how the cardiovascular system reacts to long flight. And each day on this amazing orbiting research facility, we collaborate with other nations to live and work together, which is critical to our future exploration beyond low Earth orbit. I want to thank you for your support and wish you the best of luck at your conference. And since you are scientists, after all, or mostly interested in science, instead of flipping around just to prove that I'm in space, I have a little demonstration. And you can't do this at home. All right. When will the ball stop? It just does it by itself. That's cool. I hope you guys have a great conference. Goodbye from space.
Who else? Who else?
Well, I got two words. Two words, Bob.
Fuck yes!
Who else got goosebumps? Come on, that was amazing.
That was cool. All right. So, come on, everyone here is familiar with the three laws of robotics, right? Isaac Asimov got them memorized. For the one person who doesn't know what it is, that's Isaac Asimov hypothesized if we had artificially intelligent robots, we would have to sort of build in, really cook into their fundamental hardwiring some laws so that they can't get out of control, right? So there won't be a robot uprising. The first and primary rule was that a robot can't harm a human being or allow a human being to come to harm, even just passively. And this is, it was a thought experiment, and although he built an entire series of books out of this thought experiment, a lot of nerds and geeks and computer scientists and like actually serious AI researchers have taken this thought experiment further, and this is a recent article that was actually published speculating that maybe there is Asimov already did this, I have to say, but a zeroth law, like a law that's even more fundamental than the first law, or in this way, in this case, they're actually saying you could replace all the laws with one law, and that is, the law that they follow is that humans must flourish. Mm-hmm. So, which is an interesting approach to the whole laws thing. I think it's...
I like it.
So let's talk about, I promise you we won't spend the rest of the show talking about this, but...
We can if you want.
Well, it's interesting. So I think it's good in that it is comprehensive, but it's really vague. I mean, then how do you define flourish?
Right. One law with 100 sub-laws, to be explicit. Otherwise, forget it.
And
right.
Is it saying each individual human being must flourish or the species must flourish?
Well, it didn't say humanity. It said humans. But that's exactly the kind of thing that a robot's going to have to interpret. Mm. So like if you have a serial killer... Do they take that guy out because more humans? So again, you're right, Bob. There's 100 sublaws in there, and so it almost becomes superfluous at that point because it's the 100 sublaws that are really going to be the laws of robotics,
the meat, right?
Yeah,
right.
The meat. But it doesn't replace all of them because what is it? The third law that says it should protect itself at some point.
Right.
So it wants some kind of self-protection. But I do like it as a supplement, like a 1A or whatever to the first law.
I'm not sure I do, to be honest with you. I mean, because so much then depends upon how the robot interprets that.
Could you say that animals on the farm flourish?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So they may decide, for example, that humans would flourish under our
rule. If we're looked after.
Yeah. So like they can't take care of themselves. So we need. So
right.
What does flourish include? Liberty or just not dying?
How about you could argue that the humans in the Matrix flourished in a way in their little pods, unconscious. I mean that, right? They kind of flourished.
A robot might think that's flourishing, you know.
Well, and also, isn't this kind of moot? Do any AI or like robotics researchers actually take this into account?
No, this is massively premature.
Yeah,
bottom line.
Well, and it's a thought experiment because in the books, they actually the books largely are about the manipulation of those laws. Like
and
that's
and
what's fun about
failed.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. Where they failed, right. Which is ironic that you know we got these laws. Oh, these laws are great, but here's a whole bunch of stories on where they could go wrong.
Right. I love the one where the robot is kind of trapped at a certain distance from a dangerous area. So he's trying to protect himself, but then not let something else happen at the same time. And sort of the balance of those two, like the second and third commandment, had him trapped at this certain distance. And right. So anyway, that's the way that those laws would fail.
Right. And Isaac's laws were towards the end of the series. They came to the conclusion that these laws are good. They're good for scientists when interacting professionally with robots, not for
everyday people.
Mm. How about a kid? How about a kid giving an order to a robot? Like, Jay, if your kid Dylan could order robots around, I would be very afraid.
Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. That's not good. All right, so this is where I took it. Think about driverless cars.
Yeah.
Just for fun, apply these rules to driverless cars. You know, we're already talking about the train philosophical puzzle, like, you know, the train kill one person to save three people dilemma. Mm. And they're using that type of logic gate thinking to come up with how should the cars behave, because it's going to be a computer doing the whole thing. Now, it's not conscious, but it still has an algorithm that it has to go through to figure out who lives and who dies, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, so then that's we talked about that before. We're going to have algorithms built into, you know, AI-controlled devices like cars that will take into consideration things like morals and ethics. That doesn't mean that they will have morals. It means
even humans don't agree on those moral and ethical quandaries. So how are these things going to be programmed in? And whether or not a robot is recursive, I don't think... Obviously, we've had this debate about whether or not they need to be conscious, and you and I agree that they don't need to be conscious, but just because they're recursive doesn't mean they're going to be able to solve an ethical thought experiment any better than our best philosophers can. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an arbitrary distinction.
Yeah, but we do that all the time, right? They're called laws, right? Mm-hmm. We pass laws, even though there's disagreements about exactly what they should be and how to interpret them, and then case law evolves. And I think those kind of algorithms, we'd make our best judgment.
Yeah.
There'd be a consensus, they'll evolve. You know, as incidents occur that challenge our current, you know, algorithms, we'll tweak them. So that's all happening. I think it's fun to talk about it ahead of time. Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to...
And imagine, I mean, these are laws that would be running in virtual minds. You could run them in simulations.
I would hope you would.
Here's a century of refinement that happened over the weekend, you know?
With virtual humanity, yeah.
Would there be a robot Supreme Court?
Hey, you know,
would we be able to raise
robot,
that to a higher story?
That would be a great short story. We have to give this to our friend Brian Trent. So you have the whole story.
I want a percentage.
Think about it. The whole story is about a robot uprising or robots who are trying to follow the laws. But it leads them into this, you know, place where they decide that they have to destroy humanity or take over humanity or enslave them.
They have to lovingly destroy us?
Yes. To protect us.
Like we do with
our own good.
And then at the end, after humanity is destroyed, then you come back and the scientists are like, all right, simulation number 2803 failed. Let's figure out why that failed and tweak their algorithm and do what
exactly.
But what if there's a government decides that their computers and robots don't need to abide by these laws? We'd get robot wars or something.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are for civilians.
Who imposes these laws on the robots?
Well, yeah, that's true. Right now, there's no international body that necessarily that does that.
What was interesting about Asimov was that those laws were baked into the positronic brain itself, and there was actually no way
to disentangle them
to create a brain without those laws. So
all right,
his out.
Moving on, I'm showing a picture of a very well preserved fossil. This fossil is about 234 million years old. It is of a species called Eusaurophagus dalsisoi. That's probably not too bad.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, Eusaurophagus. This is only the second specimen of this species that we've ever found. And this is a basal reptile, right? So it's fairly soon after the evolution of reptiles themselves. This is a juvenile. It's covered with armor plating, and it's got spikes all around the outside, so it's cool. Not a dinosaur, just a basal reptile. But looking at that picture, guys, you could look behind you. What do you think is special about that fossil, the fossil itself?
It looks like an alligator.
Yeah, it's a reptile. It's an armored reptile.
The ribs look pretty complicated.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on there.
I mean, it's just really well preserved.
It's
intact.
Really well preserved. Yeah. It's actually, they're saying this is a 100% intact fossil.
Yeah. Oh, intact.
I don't see any missing bones.
Yeah, they have every bone.
Never heard that before.
Which is rare. I know, I've never read that. That's why I threw this up there. Like, wow, I've never read that exactly.
Even the head looks a little messed up.
It's messed up, but all the bones are there. They're just crushed under the weight.
Yeah.
Does it show an outline of soft tissue there, or I'm not seeing that correctly?
I don't think so. Though that outline are spikes around the outside of the armor. I think it's what you're seeing there. So the other thing, that one little interesting tidbit here is they thought that these creatures were largely aquatic based upon the 40% first specimen that they had. But this 100% specimen, they realized, nope, this was a terrestrial animal. It may have gone into the water, but it was not tweaked for swimming. It was tweaked for walking on land. So that changed our conception of this species. Not surprising. It's only the second fossil we found of it.
And
but
it's small, Steve. I don't know that they can see
the
measurement.
Yeah, 2 millimeters. It's small. Yeah.
It's actually small.
Oh, because it looks like it's the size of an alligator to me.
Right.
Yeah, but
it has a crocodilian like shape to it a little bit.
So, Richard, over the conference, we have been talking a little bit about just the skeptical endeavor. How are we doing? What should we be doing? Are we making any progress? And I, as an American skeptic, I often look to the UK and Australia, see how they're doing. And honestly, we've been saying for the last couple of years, you guys down under are kicking ass. You really are. And and on this issue in particular, homeopathy. So give us an update on what's going on.
I'm pleased to say it. We do have our successes. But there's one thing that holds us back, and it's a terrible thing to admit, but Steve, I've never had a quickie with Bob.
Wow.
All right. Jesus, Bob, you really got fans now, man.
Wow. Okay. You paid them well, Bob.
Thank you.
That was a little premature, Richard, but we'll go.
Thank you, Richard.
I had to work.
I don't know how you do quickies in Australia, but gird your loins.
Upside down. Upside down.
So,
did you say upside down? All right. Okay.
So, quick. All right, I've got to be quick. This is going to be difficult. So two scientists have advanced this idea, this theory, this hypothesis that advanced gravitational wave detectors can at some point in the future perhaps detect gravitational waves, which are ripples in space-time caused by titanic events like colliding black holes that reveal these hidden dimensions that are beyond the three dimensions of space and time that we know today. So I need this to happen. I need new physics. I need new particles because the LHC hasn't found squat in half a decade.
Yeah, but Brian, what the hell is up with that? Brian
found,
wept.
Yeah.
It's your fault. It's
Brian.
Yeah.
Brian Leonard, back me up here. They haven't found anything. The Higgs boson, wow, that was great, but that was 5 years ago. They're looking at higher energies. They haven't found dark matter, no particles for dark matter, no cousins or siblings of Higgs, no leptoquark, and no super symmetry particles.
Yeah.
Hello. They've been looking for 30 years. They've been thinking, yep, we're going to find them tomorrow, and they have not found them. It looks like they may not even be there, and that's crazy.
Bob, your attitude sucks.
No, Jay, come on, I want stuff to happen.
Well, give them time, man. That machine takes like 5 weeks to turn on,
This theory, the community has invented it, could be a long shot, but it's interesting. So what their idea is that if you look at these gravitational waves at some point in the future from advanced machinery, like LIGO 5.0 or whatever, you could observe the effects of hidden dimensions. So one of the effects that they think they may find is something called breathing mode, which means that there's some deformation to the gravitational waves that are distinctive of hidden dimensions. So that's one way, that's one thing they could find, although that would take something like 3 LIGOs, LIGO times 3 to potentially detect that. The other thing that they may have an effect is called massive tower. I'm not sure where that came from, but that basically means that very high frequency gravitational waves, say 1,000 hertz, 1,000 cycles per second, that would be wonderful, but they would need a sensitivity of about 3 orders of magnitude, at least 3 orders of magnitude, and maybe even more than that. And that's going to be really, really tough because
you know
how sensitive they are. These LIGO right now is sensitive to the wolves walking on the backyard of where they're recording this. So super sensitive, the most sensitive device in history. But if they do detect those waves, that would kind of be clear evidence, like, wow, because we have no idea how these high frequency gravitational waves would be produced other than hidden dimensions. So that would be a great discovery. But of course, they're skeptics. Don't you hate skeptics sometimes? They can just be so annoying. One guy is some punk named Bob Agaria. He's a professor of theoretical physics at King's College, whatever, right? He's saying stuff like, well, you know, these frequencies are going to be too high. We're not going to be able to detect them. Or he thinks that if we do detect them, it doesn't make sense because the hidden dimensions would be too big to be detectable. So he's a little skeptical. But hopefully this Bob is right and that Bob is wrong. So that was your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Thank you. I have now had a quantum quickie with Bob.
I hope you're satisfied.
I'm very satisfied.
They always
know when I've had enough. You didn't get out of your news item, Richard. You still got to tell us about homeopathy.
Okay, so yes, very kind words. We're all in this for the long game. We really are. We have to work at things and work at things. And I know people come and go and they get burnt out because the progress isn't quick enough. We look at things in terms of decades, but things do happen. Now, homeopathy in Australia, I imagine it's the same in every first world country. It's entrenched to an extent, but we have had some successes of late. Now, just briefly, the major, I guess, outfit in Australia pushing homeopathy is an outfit called Homeopathy Plus. And I get their regular newsletters, which are every week, twice a week, I think. And they bring us stories like, are homeopathic remedies made from pork? Homeopathy officially recognized in Switzerland, whatever. Canine bone cancer trial. Just, they gather news and bits and pieces like this. They came under fire a few years back, around 2012, when they were recommending homeopathic treatments to prevent and treat radiation sickness. This was after the Fukushima reactor.
Were they like shining a light on you or something?
Well, they say one of the recommended homeopathic remedies includes x-ray.
Yeah. How do you water down an x-ray?
Well, yeah.
Just give like one photon?
Yeah.
Something like that. Well, please bear in mind, but from these people's point of view, homeopathy works. That's their point of view completely. So anything that sounds crazy to us, to them, is completely rational and makes sense because homeopathy works.
And, you know, just as a side point, Richard, because I've had the opportunity to talk to homeopaths, and of course, you know, you confront them on the lack of evidence and plausibility and all that sort of stuff, and they always say the same thing. Like, well, how do you know it works? And their answer is because I've seen it work.
Yeah.
That's it. I've seen it work in my practice.
It's the ultimate evidence
personally.
For a lot of people.
Yeah. It's anecdote. Yeah. And so that's that then becomes their starting point. So it doesn't matter how crazy it is. They know it works.
They know it works.
So they can only conclude that we just don't know how it works.
Yeah. And I know it works because it works for me is the other one. Yeah. That's pretty tough. In 2012, during our annual convention in Australia, we'll get to more about that soon, when James Randi was our special guest. Our annual Bent Spoon Award for the most preposterous piece of paranormal or pseudoscientific piffle was awarded to Fran Sheffield, who runs Homeopathy Plus. And it was great to have James Randi read that out for advocating the use of magical sugar water in place of tried and true vaccination for many deadly diseases, most notably whooping cough. Now, because this Homeopathy Plus outfit were promoting homeopathy for whooping cough, this did actually lead to government action against them, and in 2015, the federal court in Australia ordered Homeopathy Plus to pay penalties of $115,000 for promoting this, which was...
That number doesn't even seem high enough to me.
It's very low.
Yeah, it's amount.
Well, it's... Okay, you look at it that way, but from our point of view, it's a court victory against them.
That's true. It's a ruling in the right direction.
That's pretty important.
Definitely.
And according to the Australian dollar, well, I don't know, it's probably a lot of money in Australia. plus legal costs, which is substantial, which was really great.
Yeah, because it sounds to me legal costs could have been 10
could
times
been,
that, right?
A lot more.
Yep.
So, and there's another outfit in Australia called Brower, James Randi held up a packet yesterday.
That was Highlands.
Yeah, I guess Highland. It's the equivalent. When you go to a pharmacy in Australia and you go to the natural section or whatever, it's the Brower range you'll probably find. And when I pop the pills back in Australia in public talks, it's the Brower sleeping pills that I guzzle down. And it gets amazing reactions when people don't realize what we know.
Yeah.
They're really harmless. So The Australian government, the National Health and Medical Research Council, which is an arm of the Australian government, released a paper in 2015 on alternative medicine, and one of their conclusions was the National Health and Medical Research Council today released a statement concluding that there is no good quality evidence to support the claim that homeopathy is effective in treating health conditions. That was pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. And again, that's something we've got in our arsenal now. And not so long ago, earlier this year, the Therapeutics Goods Administration, and again a government arm, was seeking comments by the general public and concerned people for a new framework about regulation on low-risk products, which homeopathy falls into that category, low-risk products. That's how they can get away with putting all sorts of things in the pharmacy because there are less regulations. Just last week or the week before, the interim report, so this is their findings so far, concluded or is going to recommend that homeopathic products be no longer sold in pharmacies. This is yes. Huge. Wow. This is very hopeful, very hopeful. And you can imagine the homeopaths are... Well, it confirms all what they know is fact, that it's a conspiracy, right? The right. Government conspiracy right. Against them. The other recommendation it looks like they're going to put forward is that... alternative medicine and real medicine be separated in the pharmacy. So you never get to a situation where you look at a long shelf of medication and it's sort of mixed up. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's a big plus.
They should just label all the old, like come up with like an icon that everyone can recognize, you know, like a bull taking a crap or something. Put that on all the alternative medicine stuff.
So that's in a nutshell, it's appropriate when you're talking about homeopaths. In a nutshell, that's what's happening in Australia, but believe me, folks, it doesn't happen overnight. There's a lot of work, not only by people like the Australian Skeptics pushing hard. There's the Friends of Science and Medicine, mm-hmm. which are a wonderful outfit in Australia. It's a long process, but what I want to say, Steve, and I'll pass it over to you for a quick comment. There's a movie just about to hit Australia called Just One Drop, which is advocating homeopathy. And I mentioned, Steve, because you appear in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. So this was like, I think this is maybe now 5 years ago they filmed me for this.
5 years?
Yeah, a long time. Whatever. It's probably a bad sign for them that it's taken so long to get it out.
Yeah, but you don't age. You look just the same in them.
But I had a long conversation with the showrunner, the person who was basically producing the show, the documentarian, about homeopathy because... You know, I always have to think, should I accept this? Should I do this? And it's a long calculation, but I figure, okay, well, I'm not going to make it worse by being in it. You know, they could try to exploit the fact that I'm in it, but you have to make sure you never say anything that could be taken out of context. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know how that worked out. But I could not convince the producer that homeopathy wasn't legitimate. I mean, just she was unconvinced. She already made her conclusion. She wasn't investigating homeopathy. She was setting out to prove it.
Yep.
So I thoroughly expect the movie to be nonsense.
Yeah, my guess is they're going to dilute what you said.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh. Oh, Evan.
Good grief. But just before I end my little segment, of course I bring the New York area and this conference official greetings from the Australian Skeptics, skeptics.com.au. I have some free magazines for the first people who want to come up and grab them, our journal. We've been going since 1981. We're wow. One of the oldest skeptical outfits. And if I do say so myself, we do kick goals. So thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Richard. It's not outer space, but we'll take it. I mean, Australia's kind of far, but, you know.
Yeah. Oh, skepticzone.tv.
Yeah.
All right. Kara... So should women eat their placenta or feed it to their kids?
Hmm.
Oh my God.
That photo behind us is actually placenta. That's yeah.
That was lunch, everyone. Good.
Yeah.
Nice segue, Steve.
So there are a few companies that do this. Puget Sound Placenta, Northern Virginia Placenta Specialist Collective.
Placentas are us.
Yeah, anyway. Right. the Austin Womb Collective.
That one. I like that one.
Is that real?
Yeah. And so what happens is women, before they give birth, will register with these companies, pay them a fee, and then the placenta is removed. And somehow, you know, made inert, like frozen or something like that, sent to these companies, and then the companies will process the placenta. There's no standardized way to do this. Some of them freeze dry, some of them dehydrate, grind it up into a powder, and then encapsulate it, like you see there. So there's a report that actually came out in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, where they just talk about new stories.
It's always a little ominous.
Yeah, it's ominous.
I mean, the morbidity and mortality.
I know.
Report.
This person,
not a good thing.
This person didn't die, but became violently ill. And no surprise, it was from eating placenta. And it wasn't actually mom that became so critically ill. It was her infant. So, yeah. So what happened is that an infant presented with a streptococcus infection, strep, and her throat became so swollen that it was difficult for her to breathe. Ooh. And they brought her into the hospital in Oregon and did a strep test, found that she was positive, gave her, and luckily it was not antibiotic resistant, so she was able to take amoxicillin. It was a long course, or something like a 10-day course. She was in intensive care, and then they were able to release her from the hospital. And 3 days later, she presented with strep again and came back in, went back into the NICU, and doctors couldn't figure out what was going on. How is this baby contracting strep so readily? One of the nurses or physicians was looking through mom's chart and realized that mom had her placenta prepared. And so when they asked her further, did you ingest it? What are you doing with the placenta? She says, yeah, I'm taking these pills 3 times a day. They told her to stop taking them immediately. They took the pills, tested the pills, and they were positive for a genetically identical strain of strep.
Whoa.
So it turns out that mom's pills were infected. She was taking them, and strep can pass through digestive tract and through skin. And she was likely passing this infection onto her infant child. And obviously, unbeknownst to her child was just getting ill, and nobody could understand why. It was not, I think, in the forefront of anyone's minds. So, you know, I think what this story really illustrates is that there's a lot of, obviously, pseudoscience, especially in medicine, or alternative medicine, I should say. Eating a placenta is nothing new. People talk about it all the time. And the people who wrote about this for popular media really focused on the celebrity angle, because people like Kim Kardashian have famously eaten their own placenta. People like Alicia Silverstone, they talk about it. They show pictures on their Instagram. And what kind of better way to influence a shitload of people than to have somebody with millions of followers on social media talking about the health benefits? They talk about how it prevents postpartum depression, how it helps with depleted nutrient, none of which has any scientific evidence to back it. Yet you have a healthy, beautiful, you know, genetically perfect human being talking about how when they were pregnant, they ate their placenta, and look how, you know, shiny my hair is, and look how much I didn't have, look how much I didn't get sad after my baby was born. And so people will do this.
Kara, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So clarify, where did the strep come from originally?
The placenta itself.
The placenta itself was likely infected. I mean, they can't say
colonized.
For sure.
No,
yeah. But it could
have. Strep's a common.
Exactly. Strep is really
infection.
Common.
Okay.
But I mean, they can't say for sure that the placenta itself was carrying it when she was giving birth. It could have been that a technician in the lab where it was packaged.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's no way to know that. All they know is that the genetic signature of the placental pills was the exact same as the infection. So they know that the baby got the infection from those pills going through mom's body.
So does breast milk have anything to do with this?
They actually tested her breast milk, and it was negative,
okay,
which is
good.
Why they were confused at first, and they couldn't figure out how baby was getting this. So they think it was actually physical contact, a skin contact infection. Luckily, baby's okay. Baby didn't die. Mom is okay. And learned, obviously, a really important lesson there. But I think, again, the reason that these kinds of stories are really important to tell is because a lot of times when we think about alternative medicine, and even, you know, Richard was talking a little bit about how in Australia, these are considered like low-risk things, right? Because, of course, a sugar pill, a pill with just water in it, can't possibly make you sick. But I was nervous watching Randy eat all of those sleeping pills simply because if it's pure homeopathy, it's fine. The problem is we don't know what's in those things because there's no regulatory mechanism in place. And just like there's no protocol for how hot do you heat up the placenta when you're cooking it before it's encapsulated, you know, it needs to be heated up for something like 100. Actually, these field notes give a formula for how high this thing should. 115 to 116 degrees Fahrenheit is how the company says that they did it. But that, for example, is not high enough to kill strep, and it might not be high enough to kill salmonella either. Mm-hmm. So it would be very easy for these pills to contain infectious agents. There's no regulation for how they're packaged. It's not medicine, which means it's not a legitimate pharmaceutical company that's putting these
trusting
things
out. A quack company.
You're trusting
to do
a quack
it,
company.
Right.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. I mean, you mentioned Highlands, the baby teething, had belladonna at strengths that was risky to infants. Like, they weren't even doing good homeopathy, and they were putting these babies at risk.
Good homeopathy doing what?
Right? They weren't doing it by the book. You need to dilute it more so it's less risky.
Please be competent in your pseudoscience.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Yeah.
But, I mean, we do have to reinforce the idea that eating your placenta is just silly.
There's
no science there. I mean, the notion that it's a superfood, there's some nutrients in there. There's nothing in there that you can't get from food.
No, there's so much folk wisdom behind it. You know, a lot of people argue, but all mammals eat their placentas. Well, my dog eats his own throw up.
Right.
I don't want to do that.
That's right.
My dog eats his own shit.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Right. I could top that. Yeah. I could top that, but I'm not going to say it.
All right, I'll trust you.
No.
I hope
not. And also, animals in the wild are living on the brink of starvation all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not our problem in the West, at least. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
Right? All right. Who knows what this number is? Don't shout it out.
I do.
So, all right, I'm going to give it. If you know what this number is, give me a clap now.
Wow.
All right, good on you.
Wow.
I know Brian's in the back going, ooh, ooh. Bob, you knew what this was. I showed it to you. Yeah. What is it?
Planck's constant. Quantum of action.
So it's 6.62606993 times 10 to the minus 34, and that's what units. You know what the units are?
Oh, you bastard.
It's energy times time, so it's joules per second squared, per second minus one. And it's, it's kilograms per meter squared times seconds to the negative one or something.
That's just joule seconds, right?
Joule seconds. Thank you.
Basically showing that energy is quantized, bottom line,
right? Energy is quantized, right, exactly.
Big,
so why am I showing
very important,
this
very important. Big
so... Thing. Yeah, so that's a fundamental aspect of the universe. So I was thinking when I was looking at this number, wouldn't it be cool? And what would you guys say if the number were 6.66 exactly? As a skeptic, I would go, that is damn curious.
That's a
pretty amazing coincidence.
I would love it.
Can I ask for clarification?
That's a mind fuck, Bob? My God.
When you say energy is
quantized.
Quantized. Right. It means it comes in discrete packets, right?
Right. It's not infinitely variable. It's so chunks. It's chunks of energy.
I don't want to derail Steve's item, but what it sounds like when you say packet that it's contained in something. It's not contained in something. It's just what? I don't know
it
what
just
it
means
is.
You can't cut it anymore after a certain level.
Like a unit of energy can't get smaller than that.
There's a certain point where you can't divide it anymore.
Right. But does it apply to? But what? Wait. Okay, I got it. I think I have a proper question here. It's formulated. You know, energy can be in many different forms.
Sure.
So what is the quantum?
Lots of different things. Like, think of it in terms of like electron orbits. You have discrete orbits. You can have suborbits that are in between other orbits. They are discrete orbits, which is for, you know.
An electron can't gain or lose less energy than the Planck constant.
Okay.
That's one way.
You didn't answer my question, but.
Yeah, they did.
You're trying to, you said, what makes up, I hear what you're saying.
Right? Think about all the forms that energy can be in, but when you go down.
You're asking for a theory of everything we don't have yet, basically.
That's bullshit then. And what's with the formula?
All right. So, the reason why.
It's just a big number, guys. Forget it. This news item
is actually a very, very small number.
It's tiny. Look at the negative.
See that? they can't even agree if it's big or small. This is nonsense. So
knowing
the size of the Planck constant very precisely is an important thing. And one of the things we do with that information, if we can get our measurement of it precise enough, we can use it as a way of establishing standard, which is why NIST, which is the National Institute of Science and Technology, they have a threshold. If we can get three different labs to measure the Planck's constant with a precision of less than 50 parts per billion, and one of them at less than 20 parts per billion, then they will conclude that we know it precisely enough that we can use it as the basis for the standard kilogram, right? So instead of having a chunk of metal be our kilogram, they want to say it's this number of Planck's whatever constant. They want to be able to make it a related to the actual physical universe, an objective standard. So we are now past that threshold.
Whoa.
That's the new as of.
So are you saying then that this could lead to a global standard for all measurements?
Yes. Yes.
Which would be amazing.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so they two actually labs using a technique called the Kibble balance. I'm not going to try to explain this in technical detail, but basically it's a very sensitive balance that uses electromagnetic interactions basically in the springs of the balance.
Oh, it's an actual balance.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Isn't
yeah.
that when you have two dog food bowls next to each other and just evenly spread them?
Yeah, kibble. That's what
right.
it is, Jay.
So they use that to measure Planck's constant, and one did it to within 13 parts per billion.
Ooh.
And then the Canadians, they actually have the record. They did it to 9.1 parts per billion. And then there's a third lab that did it. They used a different method. I think they used something to do with Avogadro's number. You have to literally count every atom in a block, a sphere Ooh. Of some metal.
Mm-hmm.
And you got that? So then, so with those three techniques, they have three independent measures. They're all less than 20. So we actually exceed 20
That's
parts
awesome.
Per billion. So they exceed the limit. So now this will probably be the new basis of the kilogram. Once they figure out exactly how to do that.
All right, but is this going to have a dramatic change to what the current state of the kilogram is, or is it going to round it up to whatever the nearest...
No problem.
Yeah, but they're going to round it to within a Planck constant, so I think we're okay. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going with this is like when I tell people I lost weight, I can really be like, I lost weight today.
I lost two units of energy. Yeah, your scale will never be this sensitive, so I don't think you have to worry about it.
Steve, what's going to happen
use
to
a
that?
Scale.
What's going to happen to that kilogram? Sell it on eBay or something?
the actual
historic significance.
Were any of those labs in Germany that did this work? Are there any Germans in the audience right now?
I don't know.
Is it making you crazy when you hear us say Planck over and over? It's a Planck's constant.
Max Planck.
Max Planck.
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 Planck. It's a Planck constant.
Richard, say it.
Planck.
You've been in New York too long, my friend.
3 days.
Does that mean that the United States will adopt the metric system? Confused
no.
looks.
Here's hoping.
The United States to adopt the metric system.
We should. Absolutely we should, except for temperature. I like Fahrenheit better. But absolutely we should. And we just failed. Like in the 70s, here comes the metric system. But they didn't commit. You got to commit. Like you can't
scientists
can't put out a $2 bill
they
and
tried.
Not commit.
That's
you know
true.
What I mean?
But at least scientists in the U.S. use metrics.
Yeah, a lot. We use it a lot. Yeah.
Except that one time that they didn't and the thing crashed on Mars.
Yeah, that did happen. That did happen.
That's what
they did.
Yep. Evan,
yeah.
Is this the head transplant news item that we're getting to here?
Really looks like
it. Can everyone see what's going on up there in that graphic?
It's a little
low to see.
What is happening there, Evan?
What is going on here? All right, so this news item comes from Taiwan, or Formosa, if you prefer. And the headline from the Daily Mail reads, cutting-edge massage, new therapy to de-stress involving being pounded with meat cleavers.
Seriously. Did
Evan.
They say cutting-edge?
Yeah.
Seriously, come on.
Evan
it gets
must
better.
Love
it gets
that
better.
Headline.
I did a little more research on this, and another news outlet had an article, and they called it, Leave It to Cleaver.
Evan is giddy over that.
How many people did not get Leave It to Cleaver?
Oh, come on. Everyone got it.
Really? Everyone got that. Awesome.
I got it. Yeah. I know that one.
See? Wow.
There is a circle in hell for headline writers.
So who's... I have a quick question, Evan.
Yeah.
I know you haven't even started your news item
yet.
The whole room was like, what the hell? Who is...
who is more stupid in this picture? The person who is administering or the person who said, yeah, you could do that to my neck?
I think the second
one. They're still
one.
Figuring it out. It's a tight race. Well, obviously the Daily Mail article concentrates on this being a spa treatment in which these meat cleavers are chopped, and that's how they describe it, chopped across their bodies, their necks, and their faces even. They put it right up to their faces.
Now it's not funny anymore.
We're not talking about the back ends, the flat ends of the cleaver. We are talking about the sharp knifed edges of the cleavers.
How
the blade,
do they do
the actual
that?
Blades. The cleavers are pressed in rhythmic motions with nothing but a thin piece of material, or in this case, a thick towel, separating their skin from the blade. But in my research also, I saw pictures of them using nothing to protect the person. They actually
the blade,
right on this,
the blade
right on
the
skin.
The neck.
Blade right against the skin.
No, Evan, they were using their kung fu to go right. You would trust that, right?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it must be a really dull blade then. There's
well,
no way
yeah,
you're
those
not
knives are not extraordinarily sharp, but still, I would be worried when the two of them intersect, it could have like that, you know, that your skin could get trapped between the two edges.
Oh, like what, a
pinch
zipper?
Going on
yes.
there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeesh. Yeesh.
Like
The Daily Mail article, they interviewed her name was Cai Mei Fang, and she's the owner of the place called Ancient Art of Knife Therapy Education Center in Taipei.
Ancient art.
Ancient yes. art. The treatment, she said that the treatment is originally from China. It's 2,500 years old. That's Everything has a yin and a yang, hence we use two knives, yin and yang.
Yin, yin.
The practice apparently stimulates cell renewal and makes the body relax. How it stimulates cell renewal, I think it would be cell removal. Maybe it was a typo or something like that. Now, there's actually a more serious aspect to this knife therapy, and it came from another article that I found, this one from the LA Times years earlier, in which they interviewed another practitioner of knife therapy, and they don't use it for massage. They use it for all sorts of fantastical health claims. That practitioner's name is George Pan, and he claims that his knife massage therapy releases the body's stored energy, increases blood flow, and washes away harmful toxins. Washes away harmful toxins.
I think people are liking increases blood flow out there.
Yeah, yeah right? Definitely increases
Hey, can you
blood
do this on my penis? I have erectile dysfunction.
Make sure but you in get a different way with that joke.
What the hell?
He speaks about chi, energy points throughout the body that become blocked, and of course this technique with the knives relieves those blockages. Where have we ever heard that before in the world of Crankville? And it works better than acupuncture needles to release and transmit
well, wait,
the
now,
energy.
This is awesome, because now we have pseudoscience fighting itself.
That's right.
That's yeah.
they needles versus knives.
They should have said it works as well as acupuncture, and that would have been a correct statement.
Yeah.
That would have been. He also claims that it can cure sicknesses, including cancer. So this is the dangerous part. Yep. Releasing the patient's energies through regular knife massage. Regular. You have to go back every week, apparently. Hits these vital energy points that can ease the adverse effects of things like chemotherapy, if you've already gone through cancer. And it helps with hair loss and nausea. Any nauseous effects
and
you
And they can
have
give you a haircut while they're doing
haircut.
It.
That's right. That's right. Now, he doesn't do it hard enough to cause any bleeding. But one particular patient was in there because they were having liver problems, and they went to this practitioner to help them with their liver. And he said, here's a quote. He says, apparently they were there while he was doing the technique, and this practitioner said, you hear that sound like a drum? And he's tapping it on his liver. He says, that's too much drinking. Chop, chop, chop. The pain will go away.
Good. It's good that he said that.
Yeah.
Because the words activate the knives, right?
Yeah, well, you know.
Chop, chop, chop.
Yeah,
chop,
chop.
Chop, chop,
chop. Apparently, lightly tapping the corner of the cleaver on your hairline down to the eyelid will relieve your headache as well. Right, Steve? Is that what you do at Yale?
You know, but if anything goes wrong, then they could just consult that Italian surgeon who'll do the head transplant.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They could do that.
They'll fix things back up.
They could do that.
With a cleaver, nonetheless.
Right. So this is, you know, this, again, is a reminder that the world of woo is often beyond parody, right? Yeah. You can't make up anything more ridiculous than this. This could be, you know, a Mitchell and Webb skit, and we would buy it as fake. Maybe this is fake. Who knows? Like, you know what I mean? You can never, it's just beyond parody.
Crazy. What else can you say?
What else can you say? That's more pithy. All right. All right, Bob, you're going to give us a very quick discussion about what's going on here. Sound. Something to do with sound.
Steve mouths to me 2 minutes ago, Bob. Quick, right? Wait, I'm not ready for quick. So engineers have designed ultrasonic sound that they claim can be picked up by a microphone, but not by human ears. And if you think about that, cool, but that doesn't make any sense because microphones are designed to operate within the range of human hearing, right? 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. It doesn't make sense. So how could they possibly do this with ultrasonic sound that is beyond, say, beyond 20,000 or 25,000, say 30, 40, 50,000 hertz. How does that work? So this is their idea. They create these two ultrasonic tones. Say one is at 40 kilohertz, the other one's at 50 kilohertz. And the sound goes into the microphone, into the power amplifier of the microphone. The amplifier amplifies it, right? That's what amplifiers do. But also, because it's ultrasonic, they also interact with the mechanics of the microphone in a non-linear way, a chaotic way, a counterintuitive way. When that happens, the frequency multiplies. And when you have frequencies that are multiplying in this way, they add and they subtract. So if you've got a 50 kilohertz and 40 kilohertz frequencies going in there, the difference is 10 kilohertz, and that's what a microphone can pick up. That's within human hearing.
But the human ear wouldn't pick that
up. The human ear would not pick it up until we become robots. There's nothing non-linear happening in your ear in that way. So
until
you would not hear anything.
Until we become robots.
What?
Until we become robots.
Yeah, then we could hear it. So what it's hearing, though, it's called a shadow. This is basically white noise. Ultrasonic signals going in, creating this shadow white noise that humans cannot hear until you play it back. Then the talking is drowned out, and all you hear is the white noise. So that's their plan. So what could they do with this? They could, if you want to have a very, very private conversation, Kara and I could turn on our ultrasonic speakers, have our conversation, and be fairly confident that no one's going to be able to record that.
A cone of silence?
Yes, a cone of silence.
Oh!
Wow.
What?
Wow, awesome. So you could do it at movie theater so that people can pull out their camcorder and record the movie, or a concert so you can't illegally copy the music or whatever.
Oh, that's so funny. When you said you could do it in movie theaters, I immediately went to, like, Courtney and I can talk in the back of the and not piss anybody off. I went to another place.
Not like that.
Yeah.
The Internet of Things, where everything is basically on the Internet, for them to communicate, instead of using Bluetooth, they're saying that you could possibly use these ultrasonic frequencies. Steve, you've got Alexa at home, that the computer that you could talk to and answer questions and give you information.
Google
Home. You could, to prevent unauthorized recording of your voice, you could use this to potentially do that. Mm. But you could also do kind of nefarious things, like you could go rob a bank and you play these tones, and anyone calling 911, no one's going to really hear what the person's saying because it's blocking it out.
Did you think of that, or was that published in the article?
That was in the article. That's an idea.
Right, that's good.
The article also mentioned something about a hearing aid. So, right, a hearing aid. It's got microphones. It's going through the system, and you play these tones, and like my parents, right, guys? Our parents have hearing aids, and they would not be happy if you played these tones. But, you know, it made me really think that I could play these ultrasonic tones when they're watching Fox News, and they wouldn't hear. So note to self, ultrasonic sabotage project. All right, don't say anything.
Right.
All right, is that quick enough?
That's quick. Yep, I like it. All right, we're going to move right on. Kara, so you're going to do a kind of a special, what's the word for this?
Yeah, episode. I thought we would do something fun this week. So, portmanteau, if you've heard that word, I'm saying it very French. Portmanteau, people pronounce it differently. The first meaning, it was a large suitcase. Like the original etymology is from porter and mantle, and together it was a large suitcase. But the next meaning, and the meaning that we're going to be dealing with today, was actually coined by Lewis Carroll. And he wrote in Through the Looking Glass, when he was talking about the words that were used in Jabberwocky, he was talking about slithy, which means slimy and light, or mimsy, which is miserable and flimsy. He said, you see, it's like a portmanteau. There are two meanings packed up into one word. It's like a contraction, except it's not two words in sequence that have been smushed together. It's just two words that mean different things that have been smushed together, so that you have a more complex meaning. So I decided to curate a list of portmanteau, and I was going to ask the panelists here if they could tell me what the original words were that make them up. So we're going to go here in, let's see if it's in the same order. Oh, yeah. So we're starting easy. We're starting easy, and then we're going to move on. Brexit.
That's easy.
Yeah, of course, yeah, everyone
knows. British exit, right? Britain, yeah. And exit. Good, good.
British exit.
Smog.
Smoke and fog.
Smoke and fog.
Yes. Didn't realize that until I looked it up. Blush.
Lush.
It's blood and lush.
It's blood and rush.
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 When blood rushes to your face.
Okay. Make rush of blood.
It's a rush of blood. Chortle. This was also coined by Lewis Carroll.
And
snortle.
Chuckle and snort.
Snortle, yeah.
Yeah, that's a Lewis Carroll word. Chuckle and snort. And now chortle is it's a word.
I guess I never knew what chortle meant.
Yeah. Oh, well, now you know.
Yeah, okay.
It's a terrible. It's like my Darth Vader. Yeah. What's a labradoodle?
A Labrador and a poodle.
Yeah, a Labrador and a poodle. Yeah. What's a sitcom?
Situation comedy.
Ooh, yeah. You got that one fast.
Yes.
Okay.
That's bad.
What is a Muppet?
A marionette and a puppet.
Good job.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
It's a marionette and a puppet.
Marionette and puppet.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's cosplay?
Costume
role play. Role play. There you go.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And we did this one as a recent What's the Word, so you guys should all get this right. What's epigenetics?
Epiphenomenal genetics.
It's an EpiPen and...
It's epigenesis and genetics.
Yes,
originally it's called epigenesis. Okay.
Mm.
What's Botox?
Botulism toxin.
Yep. Botulinum toxin.
Toxin.
Yep. What is an endorphin?
Oh,
we're getting into science ones.
Endogenous
morphine.
Morphine. Yeah. Endogenous morphine. That's why there's so many similarities there. Mm. What's a cyborg, Bob?
Cybernetic organism.
There you go.
God.
Yeah, come on.
That is such an awesome word.
What's a vitamin?
Ooh,
I know this
vitamin.
One. Vital amine.
It's a vital amine.
What's an amine? So. Yeah, so this is when it was first chemically defined. Yeah, their amines is just their chemical group.
It's a chemical
and
group.
They're vital
because
by definition, a vitamin is something your body can't make for itself, so you have to eat it.
Yeah.
So it's a vital amine. You have to, and vital in medicine,
life.
Biology,
Vitali.
Is something you have to consume.
Yeah. Like, but it comes from the root of life.
Vital amino acids
All right, I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there a vitamin-like substance that we do make that we just don't call a vitamin?
Yeah.
Like what?
Plenty. There's other things that we can make for ourselves, so they're not vitamins.
Like what? Like vitamin,
vitamin D.
Vitamin? Wait, right. We can
make vitamin D.
Well,
yeah.
Why are we calling it a vitamin?
Because you need the sunlight. You need
Okay,
so give me an example. You got one?
There's a ton of things, but now, of course, I can't think of any. But pretty much every other biochemical thing in your body, you know, that you don't have to eat, that you can synthesize.
Okay.
Insulin.
Yeah. Insulin.
Insulin.
But we don't call that vitamin insulin.
Yeah. We make
you're saying things that are actually sold as vitamins that we can just make ourselves.
That's cool.
No, I thought he just wants to know if there are things that act like vitamins in the body, but we don't call them vitamins
because
we can synthesize them.
Yeah.
So basically all the downstream products of the vitamins, you know, because we make them from the vitamins, though they themselves are not vitamins.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay. Who knows what a modem is?
I do.
Modulate, demodulate.
Gosh, you guys are too good. All right. Yeah. So then as a bonus, did we include these?
Yeah.
Okay. There are a bunch of companies that, and I started with an easy one, but there are a bunch of companies that are portmanteaus as well.
Easy.
So what's
Federal
FedEx?
Express.
I wanted to make sure everybody would get them. Okay. Prevacid. Prevents acid. Good job. Triscuit.
Triscuit decaphobia.
It's a biscuit with three ingredients.
Oh,
yeah.
Very cool.
I never would have guessed that.
Triple biscuit.
Okay. Verizon.
It's Horizon and...
It is Horizon. Horizon's
and,
the second word.
Vertical?
Think about scammers.
Veritas.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, meaning truth.
And I didn't understand why. The word just popped into my head.
All right, and here's one that we use all the time on the Skeptic's Guide. What is Skype?
Speaking type. Right? You try better, man.
Sky something?
Sky. Peer-to-peer.
Peer-to-peer.
Skype. Yeah.
No.
That's where it comes from.
My favorite one is the combination of snake and people, or sneeple.
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 Like, like sheeple. Yeah.
Sheeple. That's a good one.
Sheeple. That's a really obscure nerdy reference if you got that. That was for my daughter who's in the audience.
Aww.
All right. What's the time? All right, we're going to skip that one.
Okay.
I'll do this news item, the show after this one. It's about ticks. It can wait. It's fine. We got other stuff. Wait, real quick. Do you guys know what's going on for us? The Novella brothers and our families have to leave 1 second after the show's over to go to our other brother's second wedding.
Yeah, his first wife will be surprised.
Yeah, she doesn't know. It was the worst kept secret in the world. Yeah. They're trying to have a secret wedding, and then they booked it on Nexus weekend. And then Joe calls me. I was like, "You guys booked Nexus on my wedding." I was like, "You didn't tell us."
No, you booked your wedding on Nexus.
Yeah. So he's like, all right, well, you guys have to leave Nexus to come to my wedding, but it's a secret, so no one's going to know. It's like, yeah, no one's going to know that I'm leaving Nexus, a conference that I'm running, to go to a picnic, and there's no reason why that's happening. And then I find out less than a week ago that I'm officiating at the wedding.
That was the surprise, Steve. That's awesome.
So my brother really Joe's have to be there.
My brother Joe's fiance says, "Okay, let's go out to dinner." You know, Steve and his wife Jocelyn and my brother Joe and his fiance Donna. So they go out to dinner, and it was like,
"So
Steve, what's going to happen at the wedding?" Right. Steve's like, "What? You're getting married. You're getting married, right?"
Like, you tell me.
Yeah, but who's doing it?
You are.
Okay. So then my brother Joe does one of these. Like, oh shit, I forgot to tell Steve that 6 months ago.
Yeah. It's so funny because they tried to keep it a secret, even from me. Jay's like, "All right, Bob, we're leaving Nexus on Saturday afternoon to go to Joe's picnic. Trust me, we need to go." So I'm like, "Wait, Steve agreed for us to leave in the middle of Nexus? Joe must be getting married."
You know, it's like, obvious. It took half a second for everyone to figure it out. Okay, so that's what's happening. So very quickly, this has been going around. I'm already getting a ton of emails about it. This may be too soon if you're, you know, too busy at being at Nexus to follow the news. This is going around. So women, this is the headline from, what is it, Yahoo News, that women will carry the DNA of every guy they've had sex with. Right? That's the headline. Again, this is the circle for the headline writers.
But I still think this is a sexist headline.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah, because why wouldn't men?
Yeah, why wouldn't men?
Not have the DNA from the men they have sex with.
Exactly.
Good point.
So, this is complete bullshit. I mean, this is just not true. But it's always interesting to back, you know, to reverse engineer a news story, a science news story from the actual science news item that led to it, and to try to figure out where did it go wrong and whose fault is it? Is it the scientist's fault? Is it the press office? Or is this just a newspaper out of control, off the rails? This is the latter one. So they're spreading this as a new study, even though it's a study from 2012. So they just decide it's a slow news day. Let's resurrect this news item from 2012. And then I actually recognize this from 2012. This is like not new. And the study has absolutely nothing to do with sex, right? That is something that they completely invented. The news item, here's actually the news item. It's about male microchimerism, which is, it's an interesting thing. So what they find is if you do an autopsy on a woman and you look at the cells in their brain, there are male cells, even in a female's brain. And we know that because there's Y chromosomes, right? There are cells with Y chromosomes. How did they get there? How did cells with Y chromosomes get into a female brain? And the answer is we don't know, but there are some very plausible hypotheses, none of which include having sex, by the way. One of them is that, if a mother gives birth to a son, right, they carried a boy in their womb for 9 months, and we know that women exchange genetic material with their fetus over the course of the pregnancy. There's a lot of shuttling going on. They call that shuttling, genetic shuttling going on. Okay, so some of their male children's, cells got incorporated into their cells. And okay, that happens. That's
that should
a thing.
Be easy enough to test.
Yeah, you test it on a woman who's never had a male child.
But there are women who've never had a male child who have it. Mm-hmm. So
it's more than that.
So it's more than just that. So okay, maybe they had a miscarriage. They may not have even known it. So that's a hard thing to disprove, you know? But so I think they take women who maybe have never been pregnant.
Yeah.
And
And they still have it too. Mm-hmm. So, but there are other hypotheses still. Like, for example, it's possible that they were actually a twin and they absorbed their male twin in the womb.
Huh. Ooh. Even though from different placenta?
Oh, so it's not the case that all females on autopsy have this?
No. Okay. Just some
it's
do.
Just some of them.
Some do. And so, but you have to explain the ones that don't have male children.
Yeah.
So that's a possibility. And then the last possibility is that, well, if they have a brother, then the brother could have given his cells to the mother, mm-hmm. and then the mother back to the later daughter, right? So brother to mother to daughter.
Oh, okay.
So wow. those are all the plausible pathways that they came up with. Again, none of them include getting male DNA from male sexual partners.
So is this just, they think of this as, these are like epithelials that are in the womb that never go away, and then they become part of the neural tube and go to the brain?
Yeah, so it apparently is a lot of exchange of cells from the placenta and the fetus. It's like one organism, right? So you think about it, like, you know, a pregnant woman, they have this chimeric organism in their womb that's half them and half their child, and it's exchanging blood and material and
then
cells
if you eat
everything.
The placenta...
Yeah, right. Yeah. Then your kid gets strep. No, but it's pretty incredible then that there's at least a solid hypothesis that mom had a previous son and still has some of those cells in her,
For the rest of your life, you're going to have them.
So and is this real, dangerous or unhealthy in any way?
No, it's life. And the real news item here in the 2012 study, what they were really looking, because we know about this already, this is old news, they wanted to see if they were crossing the blood-brain barrier. That was really their only question. The answer is yes, they're getting into the brains. So that was really the only thing that they were addressing. They weren't even addressing how.
So they just made that up.
They just made that up. So then they say, "Oh, they're trying to hide the real implications of it because it's too, you know, out there. You know, scientists don't do that."
Conspiracy.
And then they went back to a 2009 study. So now this is like, you know, several years later. And in that study, it was just another study of this microchimerism. And they also didn't mention sex, but they were exploring what were the possible mechanisms that could have led to this. And so it was just ridiculous. They cited a previous study as if that's part of this conspiracy with this current study, which is not really current, and neither of them have anything to do with having sex.
Oh,
and
God.
Somehow out of all of that, they got women have the DNA in them from every guy they've had sex with. It has nothing to do with the actual science.
And can you show the other article again? I don't know if you guys can see this, but like, she looks horrified by this headline, doesn't she?
It is.
And he looks really happy with it.
He looks completely satisfied, and she's like, what just happened?
So what's the narrative there they're going for?
Yeah, I don't know. It's you're right. You said there's a special circle in hell for headline writers. I think the people who choose the images are right there with them. Yeah.
Right.
It's time for science or fiction.
All right.
Okay, each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And at live shows, we're going to challenge you all, the audience, as well. Is everyone ready for this? Okay, these are fun. I think these are fun. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that states with stricter child safety seat laws, including significant fines, on average reduces the rate of unrestrained children in half. So the number of children who are unrestrained in cars is cut in half when states enact a stricter child safety seat law. Okay. All right, item number two, a new Baltimore study finds that poorer neighborhoods have larger mosquito populations. And item number three, researchers find that young children learn twice as many new words when read to from books with only one picture per page than ones with two or more pictures. So they learn more words with fewer pictures. Okay, so we're going to poll the audience first, and then we're going to poll the panel, and then we'll go back to the audience. Okay, so if you think the item about child seat safety laws is the fiction, clap when I drop my hand. Ready? Good work. If you think the one about mosquitoes and poor neighborhoods is the fiction, clap. And if you think that children learning more words from fewer pictures is the fiction, clap. All right, so there's a clear preference for number three.
Yeah, I would say so.
The book learning one from the audience. One and two, I thought, were about equal. Mm. So we're going to start on the far right with our guest, which is tradition, Richard. Sorry about that. So let us know what you think. Which one do you think is the
I'll cut to the chase because of timing reasons.
No, actually, we have good time, so we're good. So
well, in that case, let me tell you a story.
You don't have to rush. I just said you don't have to rush. You don't have to blabber either. But
Mustic? Mustic, anybody?
Are you guys familiar, by the way,
with
the
God.
Mustic?
Just say no.
Australian candy. Jay's children are addicted to Mustic.
I'll take a little piece. I'll try it again.
He said it tastes the way that musk smells.
Yes.
It does.
It is objectively gross. I mean,
yeah. Okay, since we've got time.
Only if you don't like nail polish remover, it tastes in your mouth.
I'm going to call... no, I'll be quick. I think, because I would think that the rates of unrestrained children would be more, it would cut it, not half is not very, I think it would be a lot more. I think it would be 80% or something. So I'm going to call that one the fiction, and I'm going to go with the other two as being the fact, I think the words, the reading to kids, and the poorer neighborhoods having mosquito problems. Oh, now I'm not so sure. Look, no, I'll still go... I'll call the top one the fiction, the safety belt.
Because you think the laws are even more effective. They cut it down by even more.
I think they would cut it down even more, yeah.
Okay. Evan?
I was thinking just maybe the opposite. I don't know how up to speed people are really on all the child safety laws there are in their particular state. I think they just think they know what's best for their own family. I don't think there's compliance that's having any effect on it. That's why I think that one's fiction.
You think the other two were good?
Yeah, I think the other two are good. Real quick, Baltimore, I think that's right. I know we read articles recently about them spraying for mosquitoes and stuff in Miami with the Zika control and all that, so I can see how poorer neighborhoods, they may not be able to afford it in some sense. And then children's seeing more words, fewer pictures. Yeah, I think there's a direct correlation there.
Okay, Jay?
I think the mosquito one is science. It makes perfect sense. I think that the first one about the child seats, I agree with Evan. I think it's obvious a lot of people, I'm a parent, I've never heard any of the laws. I mean, I'm just using an anecdote, but I mean, I've never heard anything. I just get, I hope that I'm buying the best car seat when I go shopping, and I'm hoping that that's where my compliance is, but I've never heard about any of the state's laws at all where I live. I've been really thinking about this third item about if a child's book has two or more pictures, that it the idea here is that they're not going to learn as many words. And I think it's the exact opposite. I think that if there's more pictures, contextually, they will get it better, and they'll be able to associate words to the pictures that they're seeing. And another thing that I do is I use the pictures when I'm reading the words. I'm pointing to things in the pictures. I don't know if
and you've learned a lot, Jay.
I've learned a lot. Yeah.
Nice, Evan.
No comeback at all. I'm just like, yeah. So that one, to me, is the fiction.
Okay, Kara?
Yeah, I've been thinking that since the beginning. I mean, when you look through all of these, I first wrote down that the child seat item is reasonable, the mosquito item is reasonable, and the words and pictures item is less reasonable. That could mean that it's exactly the opposite answer, because this is what Steve does to us. But in my mind, sure, a lot of people don't know about child seat laws, and what he's saying here is that in states that have stricter laws where people could get fined, so whether you know about it or not, you get a ticket, you're going to learn from that, compliance goes up. I see commercials all the time in LA about child seats and like, is your kid in the right size seat? And they show like 9-year-olds in booster seats. And I'm like, 9-year-olds are supposed to be, apparently, up until you're like 4.5 feet tall, or I don't know, that's, don't quote me on that. But up until you're a certain height, you're supposed to be in a booster seat. I think most people don't know that. They just think of babies as needing car seats.
It was height and weight.
I think number two is definitely science. And if this is the fiction, I'm going to lose my mind. But definitely in developing nations, there are bigger problems with mosquito eradication. I think it's an education thing more than anything. There's just no funding for education to get people to get rid of standing water. But I was thinking the exact same thing as Jay. I think that if there are more pictures, because this says young children, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that young children. Obviously, if you're 14 and your book is full of pictures, you know, you might be
having
a problem.
They're being read to. They're not reading.
Yeah, so young children, you're being read to. If you can associate the word with an image, I think you're going to learn it better. So I'm going to say that that's the fiction.
All right, Bob, it's 2-2 up here, so...
Say again?
It's 2-2.
Yeah.
Panel, so what do you say?
Yeah, there's not much I can add to a lot of this, but I would say for the unrestrained kids, kind of makes sense, yeah. For the mosquito one, my go-to thought for that one was like, well, okay, the poorer neighborhoods, maybe they don't have central air conditioning, so they're not sequestered inside the house on the hot days. It doesn't matter. They're just outside, inside, and so more exposed skin for the mosquitoes. That's kind of what I thought. But the standing water also sounded good, Kara. The third one, that one... To me, it was not just the more pictures, but I think the fewer words. If you're not hit with a plethora of all these different words, you've got fewer words that you then associate those fewer words with multiple pictures. I think, yeah, that makes sense that you could learn more words more quickly that way. So I'll say 3 is fiction as well.
Oh,
okay, so we got Richard and Evan thinking
and
that...
And Bob. You said was fiction also, right?
No. So those two
words
guys
are fiction,
on the right.
You and Jay.
The seat law is the fiction. Yeah, you and Bob think that... The reading is a fiction,
and
you all agree with number 2 with the mosquitoes. Yep. Let's go back to the audience. So the audience overwhelmingly thought that the reading was the fiction. Let's see if you guys influenced them at all. So if you think that the seatbelt restriction one is the fiction, clap.
Oh,
that's less or fewer. If you think the mosquitoes is the fiction, clap.
Uh-oh, we know what's coming.
If you think that... The reading is the fiction.
Ooh,
all right.
Stronger, yeah.
So none of the panelists and very few people in the audience thought that the mosquitoes is the fiction, so let's go to that one
he
first.
He looks really excited.
Yeah, he's...
Don't make assumptions. A new Baltimore study finds that poorer neighborhoods have larger mosquito populations. So that's interesting. Let me give you a couple bit things that you might not have thought of before I do the reveal.
See, he's not jumping. He's not jumping to the fiction. So I think we got him on this one.
Yeah.
That's my theory.
Yeah, hang on. Just trying to drag out the suspense. So one variable that actually could cut the other way is that, and this was part of the study. I won't tell you what the bottom line was till the end. That wealthier neighborhoods water their lawns in the summer.
Okay.
And that actually has a huge impact on increasing mosquito populations because the mosquito populations plummet during a dry stretch, right? So that actually is a factor that works against wealthier neighborhoods. You are right. It ultimately comes down to standing water. That's the factor. So amount of vegetation was a factor, amount of precipitation, amount of watering. These were all factors. But the biggest factor, and the one that actually modified all the other factors, was the number of abandoned buildings.
That was the dominant factor.
Mm. And there was much more abandoned buildings in poorer neighborhoods. For example, I think it was in wealthy neighborhoods, 1% of buildings that they surveyed were abandoned, in middle class, 5%, and poor neighborhoods, 27%.
Wow.
Okay.
Oh, Baltimore.
This is in Baltimore, yeah. So, and if there's an abandoned building, no one's going there to make sure that there isn't standing water, you know. And also, garbage, like unpicked up garbage is a huge breeding ground for mosquitoes. And again, you know, detritus garbage being left in abandoned lots, abandoned buildings, et cetera, is just a breeding ground for mosquitoes. They were specifically looking at the tiger mosquito, which is actually an invasive species in the United States. It comes from China. They said probably from car tires being imported, but whatever. And then the tiger mosquito is capable of transmitting. It's a vector for disease. It is a disease vector, and it can carry the Zika virus. So that's why they're concerned about it.
Yeah.
Also, an interesting thing about the tiger mosquito, and this is how you could probably know if you're being menaced by a tiger mosquito, the more common mosquitoes that we're used to in New York and in the Northeast come out at, twilight, right?
They come out dusk and dawn.
Yeah. They're not out in the hot sun, so that's when, you know, you have to put your bug zapper out there. Tiger mosquitoes
bug zappers don't work.
They don't work.
They don't work, right?
Depending on the bug zapper.
What do you mean they don't work?
They don't zap bugs?
Let's just say DEET. When you should wear DEET. That works.
How about the citronella candles?
They don't work either.
Those don't work. Yeah.
Let's go with DEET.
Yeah. All right.
DEET.
DEET.
That's when you take your anti-mosquito measures, whatever they are. But tiger mosquitoes are active during the day.
Jerks.
So they will feed on you in the noonday sun. So if you're getting bitten by a mosquito in the bright sunlight, that's a tiger mosquito problem.
Tiger mosquitoes don't care.
They don't care.
And they're actually stripey. Like if you can look up close, they're stripey like tigers.
Look at the tiger mosquito go. Look at them. It's biting you. Yeah. Right, guys. You know what I'm doing here? Come on.
Is that honey badger?
Honey badger. Yeah.
Badger.
All right.
So that one is obviously science. So far, so good. Which one should I go
to next? My theory was right.
Doesn't matter, I guess.
Number one.
Okay, we'll go to number one. A new study finds that states with stricter child safety seat laws, including significant fines, on average reduces the rate of unrestrained children in half. Richard and Evan think this one is the fiction.
And two people in the audience.
Raise your hands. You think this is the fiction?
Oh!
Really?
That's more than clapped right there.
A few people think this one now is the fiction. The rest of the panel and most of the audience think this one is science. And this is the fiction.
Oh! My God.
Well done.
I maintain my perfect record on science or fiction.
Yes. Good for you. Although you were right for the wrong reason today because...
I don't care.
Yeah, I know. But I have to point it out.
Why? When?
It had no effect. Zero effect.
Oh, what a bummer.
Oh, wow. But you have to dig a little bit deeper into what I mean by that before it, I think, will make sense. So, again, I said unrestrained children. Now, restrained is either seatbelt or a car seat, right? So what the laws do is make parents who are strapping kids into car seats with seatbelts using seatbelts to restrain their kids by car seats. Mm-hmm. So they shifted from seatbelts to car seats. But parents who weren't seatbelting them still did nothing. They didn't do anything. That's what they found in the study. And the question is, why is that the case? So first of all, the numbers are lower than I thought. You know, total compliance is only like at about 17%. It's pretty low.
What?
Yeah, but it's mainly, it's not from the infants from the hospital. I think everyone knows you can't take your infants home from the hospital without a car seat, right? But it's the older children.
Yeah.
And most people don't realize, like, up to age 7, pretty much by height, weight, and age, they should be in a car seat.
That's I meant 7 when I said 9, for sure. I can't tell the difference.
So it's really the parents of older children who don't realize that you actually still need to be having, it could be a booster seat, but it needs to be some kind of seat. It's not just a regular old seatbelt. And the other thing is that probably a lot of parents who aren't using car seats can't afford it, and so changing the law isn't going to have much of an effect. Perhaps we need more support, you know, for those parents.
So this study literally just looked at compliance. It didn't look at mortality or anything.
And so it's not like, yes, obviously you want to minimize child death from car accidents, but really you want to minimize the severity of the injury, and they didn't even look at that.
And of course, a 6-year-old who's in a seatbelt but not a car seat could still
get
suffer
injured.
Injuries.
Yeah, they might not get killed they'll be a bigger injury. Okay. This means that researchers find that young children learn twice as many new words when read to from books with only one picture per page than ones with two or more pictures is science. Which is very interesting. Yeah. And the reason for that, what they suspect and what they found, you know, when they were looking at the actual examples of parents reading to children or to subjects was that the children are too distracted by the pictures. And they also don't, there's too many things to potentially associate the words with, and so they don't make the association.
Huh.
Whereas if you have one picture, they know that everything you're talking about relates to that one picture. They don't have to change their focus. Kids are really terrible at changing their focus. Because focusing your attention is a very neurologically mature behavior. It requires a lot of energy. It requires fully myelinated frontal lobes, and kids don't have that. They're terrible at maintaining their attention. And so giving them even a second picture to distract them was enough to really significantly negatively affect their learning from the experience.
Myelination is a factor?
Myelation.
In focus, really?
Well, frontal lobes, because your frontal lobes give you focus. It's very high energy, and kids can't focus. That's why you don't even, like ADHD, you can't even diagnose that until kids are 7, because everyone less than 7 has ADHD, right? Because that's just, seriously, that's what it's, every child, you know, can't focus their attention. That's normal. It's developmentally appropriate. And so when you're designing, you know, interactions to maximize learning in young children, you have to, you know, minimize distractions.
So Jay, I'm sorry. I promise I won't tell Dylan to focus anymore.
Focus. All right. Richard,
good
congratulations,
job,
Evan. Good job. Good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Good job to the 10 people in the audience.
Thank you.
Yeah.
punks.
Okay, Evan, take us out with a quote.
There must be no barriers to freedom of inquiry. There is no place for dogma in science. The scientist is free and must be free to ask any questions, to doubt any assertion, to seek for any evidence, to correct any errors. That is J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Jay. I wonder why he would have a chip on his shoulder about that.
I can't imagine why. Bother at the nuclear.
Can ask any question. Nothing's off the table.
Right. Right.
Anyone here read or watch the series Manhattan? Actually, very good. I think they killed it after the first season. Right. The two seasons. It's interesting. What's interesting, which I know to be true, but which
time's up. Can I go to the wedding?
Yeah, I know. But just, one thing I want to point out is, how close they really didn't know that we were going to beat the Germans to the A bomb, and that the whole war really was riding on that.
Yeah.
And they didn't know; they had no idea what the Germans were doing, other than they were racing to the finish line too. The stakes were high. They were really, really high.
Oh, gosh, yeah. The fate of the world was at stake.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I learned that on Star Trek as well. You can't let the Nazis get the A-bomb first.
There you go. Everything you need to know, Star Trek.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me.
Thanks,
thank
Doctor.
You, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining
thank
us in Nexus.
Everybody.
Thank you. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thank you, everyone.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.